This is a series entitled Ecology and Ethics. This particular session is Hey, What's the Problem? My name is Larry Rasmussen. And I wanted to work on this theme with you all as one way of getting at the Holden summer theme, which is listen to the sacred. Now, there are many ways in which we will approach that, but one of them is to take up this set of issues around what it is that's happening to the planet. If some of you were in the session prior to this one, you've already got a good start. I trust in answering the question, hey, what is the problem? And this session will, I hope, complement, as well as the others in this series, what Mark Edwards is doing, and we're hoping for some synergy between the two together. But the modern world has, while it has brought enormous benefits to millions of people, it has largely leached the sense of the sacred from the world. And we're paying a horrendous price from having leached the sense of the sacred from the world. Not least have we leached it from the sense of nature itself, which has been largely reduced to natural resources, it's even the common way we speak of it, or has been understood in terms of inspiration or recreation for human beings. So that we do not think of the natural world as the primary and the primal revelation of the divine itself. We do not largely think of the world around us, and ourselves included, as the embodiment of God. So we have a difficult time listening to the sacred in the ordinary everyday commerce of life. And this series is one effort this week to attune our ears, give us eyes to see and ears to hear, so that we might better listen to the sacred. Now, the normal procedure at Holden is a half-hour presentation and then a half-hour discussion. But normally at Holden, you don't normally follow the normal procedure. we're going to start today by flipping that around. Maybe we won't even have the presentation, but we're going to start with a discussion, and I want your answers to the question, hey, what's the problem? And after we've spent some time together on that one, I will add some other voices, some other analyses to those in this room, if need be. Otherwise, the collective wisdom in the room will suffice for this discussion. Now, what is it that we're discussing under this topic? I think all of us have some sense that we've got some kind of problem on our hands. Otherwise, we wouldn't have breakfast announcements about special handling of plastic diapers, as we had this morning. Nor would we have had to have worked out an alternative diaper service at Holden Village, if we didn't have some kind of problem on our hands. We have some kind of problem, or we probably wouldn't be rearranging what used to be the kind of focal point just outside the hotel where the coffee breaks were held until those three magnificent firs died on us, or are dying. Evidently, we've got some kind of problem. But what kind of problem is the eco-crisis, as in the jargon these days? What kind of a problem is the eco-crisis? What kind of a problem is environmental degradation? What kind of a problem is the now rather rapid extinction of quite a large number of species? We're in the third period of rather massive extinction of species. That's the question for discussion. Is it a technical problem that we've got? Sort those diapers as a solution. Is it an economic problem that we have the kind of economies around the world which are just totally out of sync with the kind of requirements that nature demands? Is it an economic problem that we've got? Is it a political problem? The nature doesn't get represented. Who votes? For nature, who votes for future generations? Is it a political problem? Is it a lifestyle problem? Are we talking basically about too much consumption in some quarters and compulsions of survival that are environmentally degrading in other quarters? Is it a style of life problem? Is it a population problem? If so, what kind of population problem? That's the single most voluntary issue in the international scene today to talk about. So you have to say what kind of population problem, if you think it is a population problem. It may not be. Is it a moral problem? Is it a religious problem? Mark had taken up some dimensions of that case earlier. Is it a dietary problem? Is it a Christian theological problem? Is it a scientific problem? Is it an organizational problem? Maybe we just need better management. Is it a conceptual problem? To take up something from the bishop's session and the last session next door, is it the problem of our imagination? Maybe imagination got us into it, maybe imagination gets us out of it. Is it a problem? And that is to say, we not only live in nature, we live in ideas of nature. So maybe it's a problem of imagination and mind and conception. Or is it just a plain old practical problem? We just need to bump heads together about this, figure out what next to do. There's an axiom in the social sciences that goes, what people define as real is real in its consequences. What people define as real is real in its consequences. That is, we'll act upon our definitions of reality. Maybe we could say what people define as the real problem is how they define the real solution, too. So that's why it's pretty important to ask, what is the problem? Because you're probably going to decide what the solution is on the basis of your definition of the problem. Okay, I'm not looking for the right answer. That's not what's here. I'm looking for some collective wisdom that happens by way of us together sharing with one another the angle of vision that we have from where we're coming from on this. So, to say, for someone to say, I think the problem is to contribute that to the space in front of us, for all of us to look at. It isn't to say, now we've got to vote that one up or down. That's either right or wrong. I just want us to share now what you think the problem is. Tiny little piece, or might be almost cosmic in its explanation.
All these different things you listed give us a pretty sprawling array of ways to approach it, and kind of mind-boggling. It might be a little helpful to reflect that one thing is not the problem.
Mm.
That there we somehow have woken out of a kind of triumphalism that you used to have. Now, we discussed in the last section to what extent that's mixed up with Christianity, mm-hmm. or not mixed up mm-hmm. with Christianity. But somehow this faith that no matter how we messed up in the environment, it was all going to take care of itself,
mm-hmm.
dumping crap into the rivers and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But being that in my head, that really is striking, is in the life of Alfred Krupp, who had a lot to do with getting the German steel and armaments industry going in the middle of the last century, who was building these big factories in Essen, and smoke coming out of all the chimneys and steel slag dumping into the rivers and so on, and it comes time for him to build his house. Well, where does he build it? He builds it right in the middle of all of that smoke, so he could see all this progress. But there's some kind of faith there that it doesn't make any difference, all that crap, when somebody does something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And seals all the windows shut to keep the web and the smoke out. But anyway, there's that kind of faith there, a faith yeah. that we no longer have mm-hmm. in this century.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying what is not the problem is that...
Well, it might
that
be of some
of,
help. Just
that kind of, for, that, no, that kind yeah. of confidence or that yeah. kind of faith that we can simply be oblivious.
Yeah.
That nature is kind of eternally resilient.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the chorus of Antigone, you get these lines, and I don't remember them exactly, but it's very interesting. They're lines which talks about the plow goes up and down from year to year, and it just lists the things that human beings do to the earth. But she is unwearied. That is, nature is utterly resilient.
Yeah.
It will always repair the damage. That's important. I mean, that in one sense you can say that's the problem, has been the problem that has led us to us. But in another way, you're saying that's no longer.
I don't think a single one of us has that naive faith anymore. I mean, Mark mentioned James Watt an hour ago, and uh-huh. everybody kind of laughed.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes.
I just need clarification. You mean here in this setting, do not think that anymore, or?
Well, maybe I'm speaking for too many people.
I think I must be in the wrong.
You hear a different.
I hear a lot of continuing. I still hear this. You said we no longer have this, but I still hear it all the time.
In terms of a philosophy of progress, or the kind of capacity of the earth to repair it.
But nature will still hear that, the capacity of the earth to repair, absolutely.
So we don't have to worry about it.
Right.
Well, okay, I certainly overstated that.
The Bush administration.
I'm perfectly well aware of the fact that yeah, that was just plain wrong.
But what?
Speak for yourself.
It was just a slight exaggeration.
Yes.
I think, in fact, one of the proximate causes of at least our awareness is that we do, in fact, have collectively a much greater capacity to adversely affect all of nature. And we can
yeah.
start with things like the kind of plowing we do, and since we've got can do something other than, of course, pull a plow,
mm-hmm.
we can start with the nuclear energy and the kinds of things that maybe we're not all worried about that as the specific problem, but the capacities that we have collectively and in certain areas of expertise certainly made that confidence that the nature is resilient is shaken. And I think that's a proximate cause of it. I mean, 200 years ago, a lot of the attitudinal things may have been the same. But, you know, maybe people didn't worship, you know, weren't more any more respectful of nature, but our capacity to mess
yeah.
things up fast
yeah.
has accelerated substantially. technological advancements.
Technological advancements, the number of people, and there are a wide variety, but you're absolutely right. Cumulative human power to impact the world of which we're a part is, in some sense, the great new fact of our time.
The irony of using Antigone is that also in Antigone and Plato and some of the others is the realization that they had destroyed the farmland and had denuded their hills, building ships. So
speaks for itself, Mark. Yeah. Well said.
But there's always been environmental degradation at the hands of human beings.
Well, I think the component I would throw into what you're saying then is greed, because when you pile that on top of numbers, and whether we're talking about economic or the land, I mean, there are lots of people with wisdom about these kinds of things, but if changing it comes at their own expense, you're not able to make decisions about that.
Exactly.
And if we do that at such a rate and in such numbers, then it's a lot of control.
Yes, Ronald and then Dale.
Oh, I'm just going to throw something in here. I suppose our colleague over there tried to decrease the number of candidates on the board to help our voting, if it indeed was that. I'd like to add to the problem of the problem, or the cause of the problem, by saying it's an ontological problem, or in Paul Weiss's terms, it's a problem of being. There's a Javanese proverb that goes, a carpenter can't make a table better than him or herself. So part of the problem is as yet an incomplete evolvement of self and consciousness to literally to be able to embrace the problematique, I mean to embrace this whole thing. And I think that you pointed up to me and my own feelings about it by putting all these things down and saying, that's it. Mm-hmm. And another one said, that's it too, you know, and it's the problem the rabbis are arguing over a point of theology and taking different points, and so they bring in a third rabbi to try to arbitrate this dispute, and you all know the story, I'm sure, but it bears repeating, I guess, and listens to the first fellow's point and says, oh yeah, you're right, you know. Second one comes on with the opposite argument, says, Rabbi, you know, you're right. Fourth rabbi, overhearing this and kibitzing this particular pinochle game, says, he says, how can you say to him, he's right, and then you say to Shmuel, he is also right. He says, you know, you got a point too. And that was the kind of feeling I had about that, and there's something in my mind bouncing around the term shirk from Islam, of putting anything as a partner or equal to God, and something about the greed and all this, the word idolatry comes up, is believing that we have the capacity to totally understand and to totally deal with. And so there's a funny kind of razor's edge, you know, the faith, which is also a form of imperfect faith, to say that, oh, that's somebody else's trouble, you know, Big Daddy in the sky will take care of that, or nature by naturing will somehow purify itself. And so therefore we're totally off the hook and we can do whatever we want. So, you know, it's this sort of paradox that Luther talks about, you know, living as if we are totally in control and totally not in control, and sort of wondering this sort of the 12-step question about which is my part and which is my higher power's part. You know, where do I come in and where does God come in? And how do we negotiate that? And it's this kind of dance. So, I mean, I guess I feel in there somewhere in all this spate of words and ideas and references that I just let out with, that there's something in there somewhere as to what is the cause, the root cause, if that's indeed the question of this problematic.
Oh, it may not be one, but you're trying to say that it may in fact somehow
somehow it has something to do with the spiritual evolution of us as a people of God. Indeed, that becomes not only our denotation, but in a Confucian sense, the reality toward which we're aspiring, our sort of job description. We say, we hear that we are the people of God. Okay, that's like, I am Reynold Feldman. So what else is new? You know, the point is, it's not enough to say that we are the people of God. It's much more that we have a job description, i.e., the Confucian sense of people of God. And the Confucian ethic of rectifying the name, names being ominous, of saying, well, if indeed my job is to be, quote, part of people of God, representative of that, what does that mean for me in my days and ways? How do I do that? How do I be that? Mm-hmm. How do I become that?
But part of the question, I'm going to get to Gail in just a second here. Part of the question is what that vocation is. Because to bring a couple of your comments together, Francis Bacon, who's often credited with being at least one of the forerunners of modern science and in many ways a spokesperson, said in one of the works that he really regarded the subjugation of some human beings by other human beings as utterly crass. Likewise, the subjugation of some countries by other countries as equally so, when the human vocation was to conquer the universe. So, I mean, something has to be subjugated, and at least nature and the universe will mind subjugation. That is our test. That's the sense of a particular sense of human vocation. That is, we are to master and control the universe. Yeah. So that could be an ontological problem. Gail and then Bert.
I want to ask another question. Well, I
think in, I guess, practical terms, more than these.
Yeah, that's maybe a practical, very practical.
I would be practical, and then I think that given the specialization of technology in which we live, and the pieces of processes that we see, it keeps us from becoming aware of some of the outcomes of some of the things that we do. We're more aware in a setting like this, where we're very closely linked and we can see what happens if we do or don't do certain activities. But so much of our life we live with, you know, we look at this much and we have no idea what happened to that piece of something or other that we just dealt with. It's meaningless to us, even if we care about the world, even if it matters to us what happens. We don't begin to see the consequences of our decision.
There's a brilliant treatment of exactly that by a philosopher who studies technology. His name is Albert Borgmann, and the book is called Technology and the Character of Modern Life. But he says we got to quit talking about technology in general. We got to look at how specifically it works and how we work relative to it. And I'm going to oversimplify this dramatically, but he says that in our kind of world, most kinds of technology work on what he calls the device paradigm, where our working with hands-on technologies of various kinds, from the simplest, like cooking utensils, to computers, or whatever, the whole range of technologies, by and large, our working with it recedes into the background, so we see less and less and less of the world from which all of these parts come. We could care less whether the central heating ducting came from Taiwan or Michigan or wherever. And what comes more and more to the foreground are simply commodities. And so our world that we see is a presentation of commodities. What's being worked on is a part of highly specialized units of work which recede farther and farther to the background. And what's lost in the process, he says, his term is manifold engagement, the interaction of human beings having to do things together. So compare, none of us sitting in this nice pleasant room or next door is going to want to give up something like central heating. But compare a central heating unit to a fireplace. A central heating unit in a house recedes to the background, and everybody who works on it is totally out of sight. Where those materials came from is no matter to anybody. We care about one thing: warm air. Commodious. That particular commodity. And the skills that it takes to get that for you and me now are skills to turn the dial to the number that we want.
Where's he
now,
going
the folk, the, his point is to contrast that. He's not being nostalgic about this now, but contrast the kind of engagement with one another and the world and all those workers that went into producing the central unit, heating unit. Contrast that with the fireplace. The fireplace, the Latin word focus, means hearth. The fireplace is the focal point in the household. It's the place where people gather. You gather across generations. You go there because it's warm. But you also have to assign duty. Somebody's got to get the wood. Somebody's got to make sure the thing is clean. Somebody else has got to get the popcorn, if that's what you're going to do. Fireplace. You know, there are a whole range of things. And in the Roman world, that's also where the bodies laid in state, and the families came to visit. Marriages took place at the focus, around at the hearth. The shrines of the gods were on either side of the fireplace. The fireplace was a matter of manifold engagement. The central heating unit, which also supplies the warm air, has left all of the world in the background and supplied one thing, the commodity. Well, he says, in all parts of our life, this is what's happened. So that we'll, you can eat Swedish or you can eat Chinese without ever having to engage any Swedes or any Chinese. You know, just take a pick from the menu. What'll it be for Christmas this year? English style or U.S. style? Which way are we going to do it? The worlds are present as the commodity, but all of the work is done in the background. Now that's part of Borgman's point. Another part of your point is that we, as the workers doing our pieces, have no idea what the cumulative effect of all of that interaction is. And that's, of course, exactly what ecology is trying to tell us about, how everything is somewhere or another, always interrelated, so that there's going to be cumulative effects. But it's not in our line of vision because we don't run the consequences down. We don't follow them up. We don't need to when you divide up the world into pieces that are assigned to the individuals. You take no responsibility from the beginning of whatever it is you're producing all the way to the end. You only do bolts. You only do wheels. No. And like services now have gone much the same way that factory accumulation went earlier. Yeah, Billy?
Then we're constantly making choices. And are the choices made out of greed, as she's suggesting, or our own comfort level, or we are so busy? Our lifestyle is such that we have to make choices that bring us farther and farther away from the world and what is the origin of these technologies. And what you were saying about, we don't build our houses in the middle of the smokestacks anymore. If we can, we will build them out farther and farther and farther away. we still know those smokestacks are there and the industry is there, but we, there's some denial about that, maybe?
What denial?
That if we can afford to, we're going to get as far away as possible, you know, not in my backyard. Whether it's a...
It's individual needs versus collective needs.
That's the problem. Individual needs versus
collective. And we can see the collective when we go into the abstract, but when we're hungry or we're thirsty, then it's us.
Well, is part of it the economics of it all? I mean, Garrett Hardin wrote an essay that has gotten quite a bit of attention. It's called The Tragedy of the Commons. If you imagine the New England arrangement, where a green commons is in the middle of the village, and these are mostly farmers, it is indeed a village, so people have cattle, sheep, goats. The commons is held in common, but each of the farmers using the commons thinks in terms of his or her self-interest when it comes to the question, should I add another cow to the herd? The economics are such that adding another cow to the herd in the commons, all of the benefits of doing so redound to the farmer. The farmer sells the cow or milks the cow. All economically, all of the benefits redound to the common, to the farmer. When everybody does that, however, it destroys the common. But, you see, up to that point, the benefits redound to each of the farmers, and the costs are shared by all. So if you simply do it on the calculation of what's in my good or my family's good, then you destroy the commons. Hardin's point was that the planet as a whole is our commons, but that we make our decisions on the basis of individual and sometimes collective needs, but without ever asking the question of whether the commons has its own requirements for its own well-being. So I think there's another wrinkle into your suggestion. What's the problem? Mark?
Well, to sort of stimulate conversation now, E.O. Wilson suggests that the problem is that human beings evolve and the circumstances were such that it favored people who were tribal, aggressive, and looked after their immediate kindred's interests. And this is what allowed human beings to thrive over the hundreds of thousands of years that they were evolving. But you combine that built-in survival mechanism with the magnification of human power, which has occurred in the last 200 years, and you've got the problem.
If you could add a state that in a different way, which comes to pretty much the same results, I think. The Canadians have a institution they call the Canadian Round Table. They have decided that we're not going to address our common problems unless we're all involved in the process. So they've got government sector, private sector, educational people, native peoples, etc., all involved in a hierarchical way of deliberating together about what should be done. And then this Canadian Roundtable makes its recommendations to the Parliament, because and then to business, and then to education, and then to this, and then to that, out of this collective procedure. And the reason I'm mentioning that is because the Canadian Roundtable mandated the research process, And they said, we've got to look to the roots of this problem. And they went back, like Wilson, into human evolution, cultural evolution. And I thought it was quite helpful with what they came up with. They said human beings have passed now through three great social revolutions, and we're trying to work our way into the fourth, but we don't know how to do that. The first great revolution was the agricultural one. The second great revolution was the industrial one. The third great revolution that we're right in the middle of now is the information revolution. So we're talking about electronic highways, etc. Those first three revolutions, which has to do with our cumulative evolution today, all had one thing in common. They all were about society learning to produce more effectively. We're at the cumulative point. That is, we didn't give up the agricultural revolution when we went to the industrial one. We didn't give up the industrial one when we went to the informational one. We're at the cumulative point of all of those efforts to help society produce more effectively. The fourth revolution that we now, reaching this point, have to move into is to learn how to produce, and I would add to reproduce, without destructive.
What would you call that one?
I don't know if we have the eco-revolution. We don't have a name for this one. But how then to take the cumulative impact, no matter how you read that story, and then say, how now do we produce and reproduce without destructiveness? And that's why at the Earth Summit last June in Rio de Janeiro, the key word that everybody was after was sustainable development. Sustainability now becomes the criterion and the issue. And then you start talking about what does sustainability mean when we're at the cumulative point of agricultural and industrial. And then you've got your people grope for an answer and don't know what sustainability means. Yeah, Rick?
I want to pick up on your technology.
Yeah.
Distancing us again. And related to the point that Wendell Berry often makes about not being in touch with the earth or the natural processes in any direct way. With technology and the systems we have for procuring food and warmth and shelter, most of us can live out our lives without having to directly get anything from the earth to ensure our survival. We're insulated from that. And that, I think, decreases awareness of what it takes ecologically for us to enjoy those commodities. Mm-hmm. By making commodities out of the things we need for survival, we've taken away our sense of where those come from and what costs.
I think that's also part of the kind of the leaching of the sacred from the from the world. You don't have that. Yes, please, in the back here.
Is part of the problem what happens to people who are still in the agricultural revolution, or they haven't reached the industrial revolution yet? And there are a lot of people in the world who are still pre-industrial. Mm-hmm. Is part of the problem what happens to them or what we do to them in the process of getting into the next revolution? Mm-hmm.
Well, usually a question is an answer in disguise, mm-hmm. and I think you have an answer to your question. I'd like to hear it.
We have the same God. We have a oneness in Christ with people who are still back there.
Yeah.
I really worry about them.
Yeah.
What's happening to them? I think we're greedy in our lifestyle. we're greedy in the amount of resources of the world that we use. I think it's greedy of me to be here. I flew out here on an airplane. How many people in the world ever have that opportunity? I don't know. How do we ethically manage, if it's management or come to grips with that?
Just to quickly describe the problem empirically in the way that it often is. The conventional wisdom now is that about 70, somewhere between 70 and 80% of environmental degradation is the outcome of the rich world's way of living. And that represents about 20% of the population of the world. About 30%, somewhere between 20 to 30% of environmental degradation is the result of the activities of the vast majority who are poor. Now, they're poor in varying degrees, from destitute poor to surviving, managing poor, but poor in any case. And so about 80% of the world's population is responsible for about 20-30% of the environmental degradation. Now, that locates responsibility, but it doesn't tell us clearly what we most need to know, namely that both rich and poor are contributing to the inability of the planet to provide according to human needs. And the reason I said the compulsions of survival earlier is that so many poor people who are not greedy are doing what they have to do to provide for their family, and thus huge areas of deforestation in poor countries. Now, it's not as much as the deforestation that comes from the requirements of the affluent world. That's what's cutting down the rainforest, and not the indigenous peoples who live there. But the hills of India are denuded because wood for fuel, is the major source for heating and cooking. So it's both rich and poor. The difference this time is that while the rich have always had the poor by the neck, this time the poor have the rich by the neck as well. We cannot afford a world with poor people in the numbers and with the kind of cumulative human destruction. Exhaustion of soils by subsistence farmers. Now, it isn't as great as the exhaustion of farmers by industrialized agriculture. But this time around, you've got an utter interdependence of rich and poor, which rich people, for the most part, deny. But this time they can't, because it redounds. We're running out of, we usually send our damage elsewhere, but we're running out of the places to send our damage. And we are as dependent upon the fact that rich and poor together have to somehow respond. It's quite a different reality than has been the case, despite the fact that as long as people will move out, farther out. Yeah, but the farther out is no longer away.
Yes.
There is no a way to get away to. We're just about out of time. I still don't know the answer to the problem. Hey, what is the problem? Thomas Berry, a Passionist priest, one of the books in the bookstore is called The Universe Story. I think it's going to be one of the most important books of at least this century and maybe the next. We did that with Brian Swim, a physicist. Thomas Berry says our problem is that we're passing from one epoch, geological epoch, to another. And we are primarily the cause of it. We're going from the Cenozoic era to what he hopes is the Ecozoic era. That is to say, cumulative human powers are actually changing the physical substance of the planet. My generation is the last generation that will not have to worry about how to repair, about the ozone layer in itself. My generation is the last generation that will not have to worry about whether water will cleanse itself or whether the soils will be able to regenerate themselves. From now on, all of those questions, the health of nature, are questions that will be involved with humans. Choices. We have changed the chemical makeup of the atmosphere itself, and we continue to do so because we're putting all that carbon dioxide up there. From now on, you have the even now maybe not. I have to ask Rick about whether it's geological changes. Thomas Berry says things like that. Yeah. That there even geological changes are occurring in ways in which human beings now are a crucial determinant. So it is a geological change that we're involved in, and not simply a social revolution change or another phase of cultural development, consciousness raising. The magnitude has even surpassed that. Almost every session that I've been at Holden Village ended on a semicolon and not a period. So we're going to do the same. And I'd still like to hear what the problem is, but we're going to go on to other things on the other side of the semicolon as well.
The exclamation marks.
Exclamation marks. Okay. Tomorrow, I think the session is what's on top when everybody's on top.